cozy little room here.
How are we doing?
I like it.
Hey,
how are you? Hey,
yes, I don't think I'm going to quite get over to take your hand there. It would involve a natural act, so.
This is nice.
For you to sign.
Cool.
Well, welcome, Congressman Delaney, back to Carroll County. So this is Congressman Delaney's 34th trip to the state of Iowa since he started running for president. So how about a big hand for that? Now, if you haven't had a chance to...
That's more trips to Iowa than some of you have made.
Now, if you haven't had a chance to see Congressman Delaney before or meet him, just a little bit about his background. You know, he comes from a good union family, first in his family to go to college. Early in his career as a businessman, started two really successful companies. You know, was given awards for entrepreneurship and innovation in business by President Obama. And then ran for Congress. Was it 2012 you were elected
yes.
for the first time?
Yes.
Ran for Congress in the state of Maryland. You know, won there. And, you know, had you know, after 6 years in Congress, or 4 years in Congress, said, you know what,
six.
I'm going to... Six, yes, absolutely. I'm going to run for president. And he's started in 2017 with just this kind of thing, coming around, talking to everybody, you know, sharing what he calls his vision of, you know, pragmatic idealism, you know, with the state. And so, you know, I think we've seen in the debates now that, you know, Congressman Delaney is not afraid to, you know, sell his message to the public. And, you know, I really hope that, you know, if you're, as you're considering, you know, who you intend to caucus for, as you narrow down who are your top five, your top three, that, you know, this is somebody you keep in mind. Because, you know, Congressman Delaney has worked so hard in this state, and, you know, not just at his own campaign, but at party building. He helped me last cycle. His staff has been out at events. They've been doing a lot of, you know, party building locally, reaching out to communities, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. And so, you know, thank you very much, Congressman, for that, for being here, and for just sharing your vision for the nation with everybody.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you all for coming out. You know, the best day in your life is when you realize it's not about you. And that really happened to me maybe about 10 years ago. Because, as Peter said, I grew up in this blue-collar family, first in my family to go to college. My dad's union paid for half of my tuition. I became a successful entrepreneur, happily married to an amazing woman. We're going to have our 30th wedding anniversary in, what is today's date? Today's the
6th. Yeah.
So in 13 days, we'll have our 30th wedding anniversary. And blessed with four amazing daughters. So I had a life for most of my life that was kind of about striving and working hard, and building things, building my businesses, creating thousands of jobs. But my wife, April, who's very spiritual actually by nature, has always been involved in community service and public service, and she helped found a nonprofit called Common Sense Media, which has become one of the leading organizations in the country working on media literacy in children. They actually have curriculum in about 50,000 schools. And her particular focus is the effect that technology companies are having on our kids. So she's been dedicated to public or community service really most of her life. But about 10 years ago, I really decided to dedicate the rest of my life to public service because I felt like I've had a very blessed life. I've had amazing opportunities. I've lived that classic American dream story, and I had a lot to offer. And for those of you who have had that moment in your life, it's an amazing moment. Right, because you start looking at the world entirely differently. You really commit yourself to be in service to other people. And that's really why I'm running for president, to actually be the president that actually works for the American people. And I have a very clear view as to what I believe the American people need, which is they need us to start getting things done for them. What, in my opinion, has characterized the last several decades in our country is terrible inaction. And what I mean by that, the world has changed so fast. You've seen it across your lives, right? You have a very good window into what I'm saying here. You've watched as this world has changed across the last decades because of technology and because we've become part of a global economy. And these have been very powerful forces, technological innovation and globalization, working together, actually. They've changed, in many ways, everything in our society. And again, you've seen it across your lives. It's changed our economy. It's changed the jobs that people do for a living. It is changing very rapidly the jobs of the future. It's changed how we interrelate with each other. How we get news and information has changed. Our security risks have changed. Our role in the world has changed. Our environment has changed. All of these things have happened very rapidly in a very profound way. And they've been positive. I mean, across your lifetimes, billions of human beings have been lifted out of poverty. Literally, if you look at what the global poverty rate was in 1960 compared to what it is today, it's billions of human beings that have been lifted out of poverty. We have innovations that none of us could ever imagine. Diseases that used to be fatal are now chronic. Kids are born with conditions that they wouldn't have been able to live more than a day or two, and now they can actually live healthy lives. We have these incredibly powerful devices in our hands that connect us to human beings all over the world. But it hasn't been positive for everyone. And you see it here very clearly in Iowa. When you go around to all the small towns like I have across the last 2 years, going to all 99 counties, you see how many people have been left behind. You see how many communities have been left behind. And you see the effect that has had, not only on their lives and their families and their communities, but on our countries, including destabilizing the whole political system in the United States of America, which it has. That's why Trump is the president. This is exactly why Trump is the president. He is the symptom, in my opinion, of a much deeper disease that we have in our nation right now. And the disease is divisiveness. How increasingly the American people feel foreign to each other. And that has prevented us from doing the kind of things we should have done a long time ago, like reimagine and improve public education, create a form of universal healthcare system, do things to actually combat climate change, reform our immigration system, change the fiscal trajectory of our country so these kids are not being left debts they can't repay. On all of these issues, what the American people desperately need is for us to take action and start doing things, which is why I don't believe what the American people need is more ideology or more partisanship or more gridlock. What they actually need is for us to start solving problems with real solutions, not crazy, impossible promises, not extreme points of views, but real solutions. And we need a president who's committed to that. We need a president who's committed to bringing the country together. You know, the title of my book is The Right Answer. And that title appealed to me because I'm a right answer kind of person. I think for every issue, and we'll talk about the issues, for every issue there is a good solution. It's based on the facts. There's workable solutions, there's ways of paying for them, there's actually ways of getting them done. But where that title comes from is a speech that John F. Kennedy gave in 1958. He was a senator at the time, he wasn't president yet. And in this speech he said we should not seek the Republican answer, we should not seek the Democratic answer, we should seek the right answer. He went on to say, we shouldn't seek to fix blame for the problems of the past, we should own our responsibility for our future together as Americans. And he gave that speech right after Sputnik was launched. You all remember Sputnik or read about it. If you go back and read the history books, some of you remember it. If you go back and read the history books, the American people were panicked by this development. They didn't know what it meant. They thought they had lost their future. But great leaders like John Kennedy said, no, our future is ours to build, but we have to build it together. And I think we're in a similar moment. It may not be one rocket into space, but it's tremendous change in the world. Change that is actually causing our future from a political, economic, and technological perspective to be entirely different. And we have to confront this change as Americans. And we have to start solving problems. Because the truth of the matter is, this is a magnificent country. And don't let anyone tell you otherwise. We have every advantage any nation could possibly want to have in 2019. Except for one thing. We have a broken government. And there's structural reasons it's broken. There's too much money in politics. We gerrymandered all these congressional districts. People are rewarded for partisanship, not for solutions. But all of those issues are solvable by the American people. Every single one. And isn't it great that the problems that we have are solvable? If we actually solve that problem, if we actually start finding common ground once in a while and getting things done, all the other problems that we talk about are easily solvable. I believe every single one of them are. But we just need to work together to solve them. And I believe this is the calling of the Democratic Party. At this moment in time, in particular, we need someone in the Democratic Party to step forward and say, I don't want to divide us anymore. I want to unify us. I don't want to put forth solutions that don't make any sense. I want to put forth solutions that can get done and will solve the problem. And I think if we become that party, we're going to win every damn election. Because that's what most Americans are looking for. Most Americans out there who don't identify with the extreme views in these parties actually want us to work together and solve problems. Those are the kind of candidates we put up in 2018 to win the House of Representatives. If you look at the 40 candidates that flipped these House districts, two of them came from Iowa, by the way. So you flipped 5% of the House districts, and you're only 1% of the population. So you actually punched way above your weight in many ways. But if you look at Cindy and Abby here in Iowa, or the other 38 candidates that flipped these seats, they all ran as problem solvers. They didn't run on extreme positions. They ran on building infrastructure, creating jobs, making sure people are investing in communities, doing things to support agriculture, fixing the Affordable Care Act and defending it. That's what they ran on. And who voted for them? All the Democrats, a whole bunch of independents, and even some Republicans who look at this current president and see an immoral and indecent human being. And they don't want to vote for him. And they don't want to vote for that party. But what they do want to vote for is someone they view as normal. They may not agree with them on everything, but they actually think they're doing it for the right reason. Their heart is pure, and they have common sense. And that's what we have to do in 2020. If we build that big tent, just like these 40 House members built, we're not only going to keep the House, we're not only going to win the White House, but we'll win the U.S. Senate. And then we'll be able to actually govern and get some of this stuff done. Because we can create a form of universal health care, but we have to make sure Americans have a choice. We can deal with climate change, but we can't do it on the backs of hardworking Americans. We can build infrastructure all over this country, and we have to pay for it. We can create kind of digital privacy laws to protect your data, but it's got to make sense. We can do all of these things, but we have to do it together, and that's why I'm running for president. So thank you for having me, and I'd love to hear what you all have to say now. So who wants to start?
I'll start. I'm pretty concerned about the border.
Mm-hmm.
As you know what happened, that's horrible. We have to do something.
Yes.
I mean, there's no doubt about it. What would you do?
So I would do several things. And I spent a lot of time on the border in the last year. I went down there and did a whole tour of the economic situation of the border. And then my wife and I went down in January, and we took 14 law students and two law professors with us for a week to help asylum seekers make their case. And we plugged into a legal aid clinic in the largest detention facility in the United States of America, where there are 1,700 women and children. And we actually listened to the stories of these women seeking asylum. So I've been really informed by actually going to the border and work, trying to help any way I can. So the most important thing for us to do as a nation is to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And we have a model for it. It's the 2013 bipartisan comprehensive immigration reform bill that passed the U.S. Senate with significant Republican support. It would have passed the House if it got a vote, and Obama would have signed it into law. That bill did three things. Put a lot of money on the border, $30 billion in border security, much more than anyone's talking about. It created a pathway to legal status for the 11 million undocumented residents of our country, and it reformed our visa programs. It wasn't perfect, but it was a really good, comprehensive reform to our immigration system. We absolutely have to do that. The second thing we got to do, if we want to actually stop the migration trains at our southern border, is we have to work on stabilizing the legal system in the three countries where all the migrants are coming from. Because what's happening in those countries is really very simple, and I listen to the women. They have a family, and one of their children is threatened or maybe even killed.
Yeah.
By the gangs. They go to the police, and the police are completely in bed with the gangs because of the corruption. So they have no recourse at all. And so they're doing what pretty much anyone would do, which is they're leaving. We had a very similar situation in another South American country in the 90s, Colombia. And the United States of America led something called Plan Colombia, which was a coalition of about two dozen countries who worked with these non-governmental organizations who were very good on the ground. And we went into Colombia, and we literally rebuilt the judicial system so that they actually had independent judges. And that's what we have to do in these three countries. Because until we actually, we're not going to fix every problem in these three countries. And you don't have to fix every problem to deal with the migration issue, but you have to make sure people have some recourse under the law. And if you do that, migration will go down dramatically. And one of the things I've called for in my first 90 days is to have a summit with all the relevant countries, several dozen of them, and a bunch of the most effective NGOs, and for us to go as a group to these three countries and basically say, listen, you have to work with us. And, you know, what you literally do is they send bodyguards in to protect the judges. You know, they effectively put a wall around the judicial system to make it independent. And it can be done. So we have to do that. So we need comprehensive immigration reform, and we have to do that. That's what I would do. Yes?
I don't have a question, but I certainly agree with a lot of most or everything that you said. I think what we need is some humility.
Yes.
Just
yeah, we need just plain civility. I agree with you. Because this is how I look at our country. We don't agree with each other on everything. And that's actually a really good thing. Because who wants to live in a country where we're in agreement with each other? Right? But this is what I think the American people deserve. You deserve, on the things we don't agree with each other on, to have that debate be civil, respectful, and based on the facts. We used to call it the battle of ideas. But we don't have that anymore. People bring their own facts to the debate. They question other people's motives. And there's no respect or civility in the debate. But the other thing that you deserve is for the things that we actually agree with each other on, which are numerous, by the way, that we actually work on those. Because right now, those things get no attention. Do you know how many great bipartisan bills there are in the Congress of the United States right now? On immigration, on health care, on infrastructure, on climate change. I authored a bunch of them. As president in my first 100 days, I'm going to champion those things. Because I think it would be amazing if the American people actually saw their government getting things done that, on things that they broadly agree with each other on. Also things like national service. I'm going to call for national service. I think it would transform our country if the next generation of Americans served their country. In the military, by doing community service, by building infrastructure like national parks, or even something new that I'm calling the Climate Corps, which will be young people go around the country and help communities build sustainable infrastructure. If we could get this next generation to serve, it would change everything. It would change them. They'd think about their responsibility to themselves and to our nation completely differently. And I think it would change all of us. We'd all stand up straighter because we're like, we're doing something. Right? America's starting to work again.
Can you put that into the perspective of rural Iowa? Because the gentleman in Washington, D.C. says it's the economy, stupid. I don't see that happening in Audubon County, Iowa. I see little kids that are hungry. I see people who don't have beds, people with horrible debt, three jobs.
Well, in my judgment, rural America is suffering. And it's suffering for a couple of reasons. First is the population in rural America is shrinking. And it's aging. And that's a problem. Because a shrinking and aging population really hurts two incredibly important institutions in society, healthcare and education. It's very hard to sustain a good healthcare system and a good public education system when you have a shrinking, aging population. And the reason it's shrinking and aging is because there are not a lot of opportunities. So young people are leaving. And so we have to get at that issue. We have to create incentives for people to invest in rural America. And we're not doing that. I've got a whole agenda. It's called the Heartland Fair Deal, which gets at not only improving rural health care and rural public education, but also creating incentives for people to invest in rural America. Let me give you a simple one. So right now, the government contracting, you know, the U.S. government contracting for goods and services, the U.S. government is the largest purchaser of goods and services in the world. So you, the American taxpayers, you purchase more stuff than anyone. We have preferences for who gets those contracts. So if you're a woman-owned business, you get a preference. If you're a minority-owned business, you get a preference. If you're a veteran-owned business, you get a preference. I've proposed another preference. I want 25%, a quarter, of the government contracts to go to companies that have half of their employees in communities that are economically distressed. So I want to create a real incentive for the government contractors in this country to set up shop or part of their operations in rural America, where the economic trends are bad, or even in urban America, if some inner cities have the same trends, which they do. Because I think, as taxpayers, we have real incentive to make sure jobs are getting created everywhere in this country. I think we need to build more infrastructure with a disproportionate allocation to rural America. I think when we think about solving climate change, we need incentives for direct carbon capture done through agricultural practices and technology with it located in rural America. So I think we need a real economic development agenda in rural America. I think what we also need to do is get ourselves in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is the trade agreement President Obama wanted to do. That would, and I'll get back in that my first month as president. You know, this president has been the worst president for farmers that we've ever had because of this trade war he started and what it's done to prices. As president, I'll open up new markets for farmers to sell their products, which will help. Yes, sir.
Obviously, unions are a big part of your life.
Yes.
I served as a steward for 20 years. Where do you see unions playing a role? You know, the whole economic situation where money is being consolidated from the top tier. People are working two and three jobs. Iowa, Wisconsin, some of the others have been union busting states.
Yep.
Where do you see that playing?
Well, I'm very pro-union. And the reason I'm pro-union is not just because I grew up in a union family and I saw the benefit of being in a union family, which are significant. Right? Because the union contract typically covers the kind of things you need in a family to have a living wage. You get paid well, you get health care, you get vacation, you get retirement, you get all that stuff. But the other thing I like about unions is that unions actually fight for workers generally, whether they're in a union or not. Every protection a worker has in this country can be traced to a union fighting for it. And so as unions have become smaller, not only have you lost the specific benefits that unions provide a certain number of human beings, but you've lost their voice and clout in the larger debate for workers. And that, I think, is in many ways has been the biggest problem. Because unions are the only people who wake up every day and fight for workers. You know, politicians, you know, we wake up every day and we've got a lot of things we fight for. Right? We've got a lot of things. We fight for immigration. We have foreign policy priorities. You know, we have all kinds of priorities. Because that's our job. Our job is not to be one-trick ponies. Our job is to work on lots of issues. Unions have one job. Fight for workers. Fight for workers. That's all they do. And as a result, and they're good at it. I mean, you drive down the highway, chances are the construction workers that you see are not in a union these days. But they're wearing a safety vest. Right? And they're wearing steel-toed boots and a hard hat. Who fought to make sure those workers have those protections? The unions. And everything. So you know, I think that you we have to support workers' rights to organize. And if, you know, you have something in Iowa here called this right to work laws, right?
Got it. Okay.
Which is clever marketing for terrible policy. You know, they're trying to pass a federal right to work law. We really got to fight that. Yes?
Thank you for being here. I ran for public office for about 9 months one time in my life, and I so admired your...
You're still thinking about it, aren't you?
No, I'm not. But your tenacity in this campaign and, you know, how dedicated you've been to this, I can't imagine it. And I want to thank you also for supporting local campaign, because as Democrats, you know, we have to build this. I know. And I guess my issue now is I've read your book. I admire many of the things that you talk about, and I agree with you. My thing right now as a Democrat is, how are we going to coalesce and come together and win this election?
Yes. So...
Because I can't fathom
it. I actually think it's pretty straightforward. Sometimes you got to take a step back and look at the big picture. So if you take a step back and look at the big picture, a couple things jump out at you. The first is every president that has been a Democrat since World War II has been a center-left Democrat. Everyone we've had. If you look at our last two presidents, President Obama and President Clinton, they were center-left Democrats. President Obama, people don't think of him that way because he was such an extraordinary and transformative figure. But you remember in Iowa in 2008, when you talk to President Obama, as I have several times about the race, he takes great pride in the fact that he believes he won Iowa in people's living rooms, talking to them about the issues that matter to their family. So think about that. He wasn't talking back then about issues that are disconnected from the average American. He was talking about stuff that matters at the kitchen tables. That's what President Clinton did. Now, there are other people who were great people who ran a little too far to the left. Michael Dukakis, Walter Mondale, George McGovern. The United States of America is either a center-left or center-right country, depending upon the winds. That's what we are. And if you want to win the presidency, you have to be the kind of candidate that can build a big tent party. You can't afford to lose people and win the White House. So you have to be the kind of candidate that runs on things that excites progressives, like creating universal health care, which I have a plan for, dealing with climate change, I have a plan for, you know, creating, improving our public education system, doing things to get rid of institutional racism that exists in our society. But you also have to be the kind of candidate that independents and even some Republicans feel comfortable with, that you're not going to do things that will cause upheaval. Because we all know there's a lot of people out there who say what I'm about to say. I find the president to be indecent, immoral, and he's a liar. And I really don't like that. But the economy's doing pretty well. Or I like some of his policies. And he's right about a couple things. You'll hear people saying what I just said. I know you've all heard. So the question is, if we put up someone who is decent and they believe has a moral compass, who they believe is a steady set of hands on the economy, and who is talking about things where they can nod their head when they hear it, we're going to beat him. Because those folks don't want to actually vote for him. They really don't. No one wants to vote for someone who they think is decent. But they also don't want to vote for someone who's going to cause upheaval. And some of our candidates are actually running on policies that will cause upheaval to the U.S. economy, like making private health insurance illegal. There's no reason for us to run on that. First of all, it's a terrible idea. We should absolutely provide universal health care. But why do we have to walk down the street and every other American has private health insurance? Why do we have to be making them think about whether it's good for them to lose their private health insurance? Because a lot of them are going to say, I don't want that. I mean, I had a woman come up to me the other day in my district. And I'd met her before. She was a Democrat, you know, in Montgomery County, Maryland. I didn't know her that well, but I'd met her. She came up to me at a restaurant. April and I were having a little peace place. And she was wearing a Planned Parenthood t-shirt. And she said, thank you for defending my right to have private health insurance. And I said, well, you're welcome. But why do you say that? And she said, well, my husband works for the federal government. And he has good health insurance through the federal government. And we have one child. And our child, he's disabled. And his health insurance allows for him to stay at home. And a lot of home care comes in and takes care of him in the home. I didn't ask what it was, but it sounded pretty intense. She said, our great fear in life is that he'll have to go into a facility and get institutional care. And if some Democrat runs on taking away the private health insurance that keeps him at home, I'm going to vote for Trump. And she's saying this to me, and I'm looking at her Planned Parenthood t-shirt. And I'm saying to myself, we're going to lose this person. And there's no reason for that. Because when I explained to this person about my plan to give universal health care to everyone but allow her to have her choice, she's like, that's great. I want everyone to have health care. We all want everyone to have health care. I just don't know why some people are saying in the process of giving everyone health care, we got to force half the country to change their health care. So that's my point. If that's the kind of stuff Dukakis, Mondale, and McGovern are on, I call it upheaval. The American people don't vote for upheaval. They really don't. Some people get excited about upheaval. You know, burn the place down. But most Americans don't. They want positive change. They want us to fix what's broken and keep what's working, as I like to say. And that's how we win.
Besides the incentive program you already mentioned, what else is in your plan
For stopping climate change? So I've got basically five things that working together will get us to net zero by 2050. And that's the goal. We have to be in 2050 in a world, certainly in a country, but hopefully in a world, where we're not putting new emissions into the atmosphere. And all the scientists have largely agreed that if we get there, that's getting us close to the abyss, but not going over it. So that's the goal. So let me tell you how we get there. The first thing we do, and I think I can do this my first year in office, we put in place a carbon pricing mechanism where we put a fee on carbon, which makes CO2 or fossil fuels more expensive and makes renewables more competitive. We take all the money that's generated from that fee, which is substantial, it's $3 trillion over 10 years, and we give it all back to the American people in a dividend. So it goes in a lockbox, so the federal government can't touch any of the money, and then every year each American gets an equal dividend. It's called a carbon fee and dividend. I introduced that bill on a bipartisan basis in the Congress. It's the only bipartisan legislation in the Congress. I believe I can get it passed with every Democrat in the Congress and all the Republicans who live in coastal states. Because the Republicans that got on that bill live in Florida. Because maybe Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley will get away with being climate deniers for a few more years. But you know who can't get away with it? Marco Rubio. He can't. He has already come out and said he wants to do something on climate. So when you want to get stuff done, you have to think coalition. You can't hold your breath and wait for Grassley to change his mind. Because you're going to die. But what you got to do is say, how am I going to get it passed? And that, you know, so and Columbia University has modeled this bill to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 92% by 2040. So that's the first thing. That's not enough. That's the first thing. Second thing I'm going to do is obviously continue the renewables incentives and increase them. Third thing I'm going to do is increase the Department of Energy research budget by fivefold. Right now we spend $6 billion a year, we should spend 30. Because we need transformative research in battery and transmission technology. If we had better storage and we had better transmission, we could cut CO2 emissions by 30%. And I believe strongly in the innovation capacity of the United States of America. But it doesn't happen unless you invest in it. Then I'm going to have the Climate Corps as part of my national service program. Part of my infrastructure program, I got a big allocation towards weather resilient infrastructure. And then the last thing I'm going to do, which is going to help rural America, is I want to create a market. So think about what we did for wind and solar. We created a market through tax incentives for people to invest in it. I want to create a market for two things: carbon capture using the land and carbon capture using machines. Because I believe we will not get to net zero by 2050 unless we suck 20% of the CO2 out of the atmosphere. Because we're just not going to get there. And you know who's really not going to get there? The rest of the world. And so unless we develop the technology that can save the world, we're not going to save the world. And this is what the United States of America does so much better than any other country in the world, which is to innovate things. We have we're the perfect country for innovation. The reason for that is we're big, we have a lot of money, we're a liberal democracy, which actually matters for innovation, because the best scientists in the world don't actually want to be in China because they're afraid the government will tell them what to do. That's actually a big thing in this country, that people can go to do research and not be told what to do by the government. So that's why we're the best innovators. We have the best university system in the world. We have the best scientific complexes in the world. And we have to take this climate problem, and I believe we have an obligation to lead the world through innovation, because unless we create the technologies that India and China can buy from us, they're not going to get all fossil fuels. They're not going to do anything to hurt their economies to get all fossil fuels. So we have to figure out ways of getting off fossil fuels that don't hurt economies, and the only way to do that is innovation. We're not going to go to these countries and say, stop using coal and natural gas. They're going to be like, we have no other solution. They're not going to stop growing. No leader is going to tell their country with time to shrink. That's never going to happen. So I think I've got the best climate plan, because it's actually been designed to actually match up with the challenges we have. Yes, sir.
I have a climate thing that I don't hear anybody talking about. Is taking the incentives away from the oil companies to break $1 billion that they're getting, give it to the American people, and make it a national goal to get as many homes off of natural gas as possible and put in geothermal systems. If we do that, right now, T. Boone Pickens is lobbying Congress.
Yes.
You know, he wants us to do natural gas cars right now.
Yes, yes.
Because he owns a bunch of capped off natural gas wells.
Right, right.
He's trying to make his second billion off of that.
Yeah.
But if we reduce the amount of natural gas that heats our homes and put incentives in for people to put geothermal, not only does it bring their cost of energy down, but it takes the demand and the cost for natural gas down, then we can do natural gas cars. We do electric cars, but people forget, if you do an electric car and you still have to generate electricity somehow, we could do that with natural gas, which is cleaner to burn than coal. And that could be a national goal, but we could accomplish it.
I agree with that. Well, as part of my climate plan, that's an interesting idea. As part of my climate plan, I've taken that. So what you're talking about is the $5 billion a year in specific tax subsidies we give fossil fuels. That's the number, $5 billion. Fossil fuel companies get about $17 billion of tax subsidies a year, but 12 of those billions are ones that any business could get. Right? But $5 billion of the 17 is specific to their industry. So I've taken that and used it to pay for the creation of the market for carbon capture. But your natural gas point is spot on. There's a facility in Houston that opened up last year, and it's called an alum cycle facility. Have you followed this at all? So this shows you how we have to be thinking. And this is actually more useful internationally in many ways than it is in our own country. So the way natural gas power plants work, and I'm not an expert, you probably are much more of an expert than me, sir, is natural gas is used to heat up water and create steam, and the steam turns the turbine, and the turbine creates the electricity. That's how a natural gas power plant works, as compared to a coal power plant, where the coal heats up the steam. heats up the water. Even though it's cleaner, a natural gas power plant still emits a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere. The Allen cycle, which is a brand new facility with brand new technology, developed by a guy named Richard Allen, who's a scientist he's a British scientist who lives in the United States and is at MIT. He basically has a whole new way of, you take the natural gas, you liquefy it, and the liquid natural gas turns the turbine and creates the electricity, and it emits no CO2 into the atmosphere. So it is completely net zero natural gas power plant. So this is what the United States has to do. It has to take these technologies, scale them up more, and sell them to India and China. Because India and China are opening up a coal power plant like almost every day. Literally almost every day. And we have to be developing these technologies to create better alternatives for them. That's how we save the world. We can't go to India and China and say, stop opening up coal power plants, because they would be like, well, our populations are growing. And they're growing in the middle class in particular. They're using more energy. We need to give them energy. We, as the United States, have to say, we've actually figured out better ways of producing energy, and here they are.
We have time for about one more question.
Congressman, I don't want to crowd anybody out, but I wanted just to give you a chance, because it's hard with a 60-second,
yes,
you know, and a moderator interrupting you the moment you hit those 60 seconds, you know, to talk about
they
something.
Don't interrupt everyone. Like,
yeah,
that,
right. You know, just to talk about something as complex as healthcare, and
yeah.
I feel like you in the first two debates, you did not really get a chance to talk about your specific
yes.
plan in great detail.
Yes.
And there's this front opening up: is it Medicare for all? Is it Medicare for all who want it? Is it public option in the exchanges? And I think you've got something that is unique among the contenders that
yep.
I wonder if you would just take the time to kind of talk about and you know, explain, you know, how it works, how's it different from all the stuff you hear about in the news, what does it cost?
Right.
You know,
so
your plan, basically.
I'm so happy you did that, Peter. So let's think about healthcare this way. So we have fixing the Affordable Care Act is right here. Okay? Everyone wants to fix the Affordable Care Act. The second thing is to create a public option, which I'm totally in favor of. We should absolutely have a public option. Then there's Medicare for All, which is universal health care. I'm giving, this is like a scale. Universal health care, and people have no choice. You just get your health care from the government. And then there's my plan, which is better care, which is universal health care, but people have choices. So this is kind of the healthcare debate. Do we just fix the ACA, which is here, which I'm totally for, but I don't think goes far enough. Do we create a public option? You know what a public option is? It's basically a government insurance company that people buy into. It's a great idea. We should have it. We should have had it with the Affordable Care Act. So I support that too. But I still think we should go further. Some people running for president have stopped here. Then there's the Medicare for All folks, who I call that the upheaval proposal. It goes really far. It's probably out here. And what Medicare for All does is make private insurance illegal. So every one who has private insurance, they can no longer have it. And you have a new government plan that everyone gets. And my worry about that is people are not going to like that, because a lot of them like their private health insurance. And the other worry I have is Medicare doesn't pay enough. Your average rural hospital, Medicare pays half what commercial insurance does for the same procedure. And the Medicare for All bill says all bills will be paid at the current Medicare rates. And if you go to most hospitals and say, what would happen if all your bills were paid at Medicare rates, most of them say we would close. Because we lose money on Medicare, we lose money on Medicaid, and we make money on commercial insurance. That's how we keep the whole thing going. So what I've proposed is a universal healthcare system, because I agree with the Medicare for All folks that healthcare is a human right. I want to go further than the fix the ACA and the public option folks. But I want people to have choice. So this is the way my Medicare plan works. You leave Medicare alone. You make no changes to Medicare, because it kind of works. People like it. They understand it. You then create a new plan that everyone gets as a right from when they're born to their 65. And you roll Medicaid into that, because Medicaid's a broken plan. So now every citizen has health care from when they're born to the end of their life. They have the new Medicare plan from birth to 65, and then they have Medicare. But if you don't have to take the Medicare plan if you don't want it. If you get it and you work for a company that provides you health care, you can say, I don't want my government health care. Thank you, but no thanks. I don't want it. You would get a tax credit from the government because you're not using a benefit that's available to you. And you would turn that tax credit into your employer to help them pay for their health care they're giving you. Or you could turn it into your union to have them to be part of the union plan. Or you could just use it yourself and go buy another plan on the market. Or you can take the government plan and upgrade it with a supplemental. A lot of you, some people in this room, I assume, have Medicare. And some of you may have supplemental plans, right? So that's how my plan works. My plan is like the German model. In Germany, everyone gets a government plan as a right, and then there's a private market that floats on top of it. Employers give health care, and unions give health care, and people buy supplemental. So I did this to kind of show where people are. There's the Fix the ACA folks, which is where Vice President Biden is. There's the public option folks, which is where, like, Senator Bennett and Hickenlooper and others are. There's the Medicare for All folks, which is Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, a few others. And then there's me with my BetterCare program. And Kamala Harris came out with a new plan that is getting closer to mine. She's kind of trying to find something between these two things. And I hope this is helpful in terms of how you think about it. And just to be clear, in my first 100 days, I want to do these things. Because these are easy to do. Fixing the ACA and putting a public option in place is actually not that hard of a thing to do. This is never going to happen. No one will ever get elected, in my opinion, running on taking everyone's health insurance away. My better care thing I think I could make happen, but it's going to take a very long time because it is a big conversation with the American people. So as president, I'll do these my first 100 days, and then I'll start a tour around the country selling people on how we can come up with a better universal health care system but maintaining your choices.
Don't you think you have to involve your healthcare people?
Yes.
Yep. Because unfortunately, we turn healthcare into a for-profit business rather than the healing art that it's supposed to be.
Yes.
And so, if there isn't some competition or something, if you just go to Medicare for All, I mean, there's so much money in politics already. I'm just afraid the whole system's going to be raped by.
Yes.
The government, I'm sorry, but...
No, listen,
so there has to be
it'll
some
never
competition.
Medicare for All will never happen. There's just no... First of all, anyone running on it will never get elected, I believe. Because anyone with private health insurance who likes it is kind of like, why would I vote on changing my private health insurance? And the Medicare for All folks will be like, well, we're going to create this new government plan, it'll be better. And most people will be like, okay, go create your new government plan. If it's better, I'll decide I want it. Don't take my thing from me. So no one will ever get elected, and they will never get approved by the Congress. I mean, it's just like ridiculous to even think about some of this stuff. I mean, I hate to be so direct, but I'm like, why are we running on this? It's never going to happen, and all it's going to do is lose this election. You're right, it'll be. I mean, U.S. healthcare is 1/5 of our economy. It's the biggest part of our economy. It's a massively complex thing. You can't throw the whole thing out the window. It's crazy. My mom used to say crazy talk.
One thing that I would like all of the candidates to do as you're debating health care is to remind the American people that the Republican Party has no plan.
Yes.
At least you're talking about doing something for people. The Republican Party has had 30, 40, 50 years to come up with a plan. All they want to do is take your health care away from
yes.
you, and they don't have a plan. Because they don't care about you. And I think that has to be the ending statement every time we have a policy debate
yes.
on health care.
And that's
the
county party
you.
Chair
yeah.
emeritus, Tim Tracy, by the
but
way.
Tim, but you're right, because in 2018, we won the midterms on that message, which is we had the Affordable Care Act. Cindy Axne and Abby, they ran on saying, this is a good law, let's fix it. And those guys want to take it away from you. And my big worry is if we run on this old Medicare for All thing, the Republicans suddenly have the winning health care argument, which is those guys want to take away your health care. Because that's what they'll say.
Yeah.
They want to take away your health care.
Yeah. And when I see that, the universal health care system, taking people's health care away, we've already got a policy plus that we as Democrats created for people, which is the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
And we need to build on that.
Yes.
But it's the Republicans that are supposed to be the party that wants to tear down the the Affordable Care Act,
yeah,
not Democrats. And we need to stop talking about that and have some common sense here on what will get us elected, because you're right, the polls show that people do not like the universal health care.
I'm going to tell you a little story about that, Tim. It happened right after Donald Trump was elected. So I was in Congress, and President Obama came to see us. And we all went to the auditorium in the Capitol. Every member, every Democrat in the Congress was there, House and Senate, maybe, you know, 95% of them, somebody in the crowd or something. So we're all there, and President Obama's on the stage. And we had just lost, Hillary had just lost, it was like a week later. We got up there, and he said, as always, he got right to the point. Because I'm not going to spend a lot of time in the election. I want to focus on what I think our challenge is. And he said they control the House, the Senate, and the White House. And the first thing they're going to try to do is get rid of the Affordable Care Act. She was right about it. And he said, listen, no one understands the Affordable Care Act better than I do. He said they won't be able to do it if you stand firm. And the reason is because most Americans like it. And at the end of the day, he said, even with Congress being as broken as it is, it's very hard for Congress to take something away from the American people that most of them like. And he went on to say, you know, I've looked at the polling, and last week the Affordable Care Act had 57% approval rating. And then he said something that I hope people don't take it the wrong way. And he looked at, I won't name the person, and he said, and it would be a lot higher if so-and-so here hadn't gone around the country for the last year telling the American people that it was a half step and a half measure. He's right about that. I mean, we've done a lot of damage. The Democratic Party has done a lot of damage to the Affordable Care Act by acting like it didn't go far enough, which is insulting to President Obama. Because, first of all, it passed by one vote. One stinking vote. I went into Congress in 2012. And the members of the House were still talking about the 70 Democrats who lost their seat voting for the Affordable Care Act. And you go to all those Democrats, they're like, it was worth it. That's why I ran for office, to do something like the Affordable Care Act, and if I had to lose my damn seat over it, fine. But don't act like that was a half measure. We lost 70 members of the House over this thing, and they all will say it was worth it. It passed by one vote. And for all these people to say, like, this Affordable Care Act thing is like, you know, we weren't bold enough or we weren't ambitious enough, like, what are you talking about? So you're 100, you know, and that's what we got to remember. People think progress is wave a magic wand. It's not. It's people like President Obama and Nancy Pelosi, excuse my language, busting their ass to get a coalition that gets it passed by one vote. And a bunch of those Democrats knew they were going to lose when they voted. But you know what they were? They were good public servants. Remember how I started by saying, a good day in your life is when you realize it's not about you? They remembered that lesson on that day.
And what people forget is in the 70s, when the debate first started on affordable health care, it was the Republicans who suggested first something like the American Affordable.
It was Mitt Romney's plan.
And then they completely switched around.
Yeah, Mitt Romney actually, in many ways, is the architect of the Affordable Care Act, because he put that in place in Massachusetts. And the reason he was able to put a place in Massachusetts is because Massachusetts had a Democratic legislature, and it had a Republican governor. And that's actually, if you get the right governor, you have the opportunity to get some stuff done. And back when Mitt Romney ran Massachusetts, he was a pretty moderate Republican, right? Because that's how he got elected, in a Democratic state. And those Democrats in the legislature, and Mitt Romney as a Republican, actually worked together and created a coalition to pass something substantially similar to the Affordable Care Act. Then we ran for president and said it was terrible. But seriously, like, you know, that's where, in Massachusetts, where 80% of the Affordable Care Act was based on the Massachusetts model. So, so nice to be with you all. And I'd love your support. And I promise I'm serving for the right reason. I always tell you the truth. And I'm really committed to get things done that are workable, that I know how to pay for them, and that I have a plan to make them happen.
Thank you.
Sorry for my schematic thing here.
No, I think
so
the visual answer
helped. In a nutshell, how do we get you out there?
Give me a dollar. If someone,
yeah, but so you that, know, I mean, you've got no time in the debates.
Yes.
Well, you know,
it's a long race.
CNN even says, you know, who's John Delaney?
Right.
You know, Steve Colbert, who's John Delaney? You know, how?
Right. So look at when people call
you
out. Well, one way is when people call around Iowa and ask polling questions. Remember, when you're asked to poll, it's not actually who you're voting for, so you can still have an open mind. But if Joe Biden doesn't need you to say yes in a poll, he's got plenty of people saying yes already. You can say yes to me. You can volunteer. You can get the word out.
Also,
yeah,
can't we all give the little, like, just a little bit of money? Don't you need that?
I need $130,000. You can give me a dollar.
Yeah, but I mean, you also need so many people to
yeah.
sign
yeah.
up for your campaign.
Yes.
I haven't. Now that you have our emails, we'll probably be hearing.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. But you can also just go on johndelaney.com and give me a dollar. I would really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Nice
thank
to see you.
Thank you.